I will call the meeting to order. Representative Biskins was the first one here, so have you looked at the minutes of March 18th?
I have.
The minutes of March 18th, he has cheated them. And any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Opposed?
Motion prevails, the minutes are approved. And Representative Demmer is getting himself organized, and you can take your time, but when you're ready, you can move your bill since you're on the committee. And members, while he is getting ready, today is a day where we have two bills before us that are looking at reform. And we have obviously a huge deficit this year, but we do have always chances to look at reforms for the money we have and the money we will have in the future. And both of the bills that we have here today are in that vein. So welcome, Representative Demmer. I think we're going to enjoy looking at your bill, and you can go ahead and move it whenever you're ready.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I'd like to move House File 1001 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus K-12 Education Bill.
Representative Demmer, move House File 1001. It's a good number. It's a big number, but it's not quite 5001. So. Welcome to the committee that you serve on.
Well, it's kind of neat because 1001, this is a bill I can remember by number. You know, I know you. It's like somebody says, your house file such and such. It's like, well, what's that one again?
I know.
I have another one. It's 700. I remember that one, too.
There's another good one. And house file 2 is a good number, too.
Well done. Well done, Madam Chair. Didn't take you long. This would fit very well, by the way.
I know it. And that's why I'm really excited about both of these bills, because actually they do both fit with house file 2. And a lot of the really exciting reform things that we have underway this year and in the policy committee do fit. And so we're all ears.
Madam Chair, I'd like to start out with a very small oral amendment.
Okay.
On page 2, members, the very last line, I think it's 2.17 and 2.18, I submitted for a fiscal note, which obviously is straightforward what the fiscal impact is, but Mr. Marks got back and said, an annual appropriation, to have that carry over is really not a good thing to be doing. So I'd like to strike just the very last line, which says, any and all grant money not awarded in any year is to be carried forward and made available to all grants in the future. We're going to strike that.
I'm sure that Representative Demmer will want to incorporate this,
yes.
But before he does, members, do you have any questions on page 2, lines 217 and 218, striking the last sentence? Any and all grant money not awarded in any years to be carried forward and so forth, just because that, as Representative Demmer has just stated, is not our fiscal policy for this committee.
And actually, I'm going to do, that one.
And I think there, I don't hear any, so Representative Demmer incorporates that.
Okay, and that's
Representative Demmer, I'm sorry, since it's an actual bill and not an amendment, we can't just incorporate it, I guess, so we actually do have to vote on that. So Representative Demmer has made that motion. Representative Demmer?
I want to expand the motion just a little bit then, because there's one other thing we want to, we've been discussing the amounts, the dollar amounts, the annual appropriations, and they were numbers that we kind of came up with trying to guess as to how many people might apply for this and what might be reasonable. And to be perfectly honest about it, we've decided that these probably are a little higher than are necessary. But, you know, we haven't been able to come up with a good specific amount trying to gauge how many applications there are for the Minnesota Council for Quality and what might be done. So I'm open to some thoughts on this. I was thinking about putting those little dashed lines that we put in without a number. This will be laid over anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we could have some maybe conversation about what fits and what could we do to maybe move this forward and make it fit and yet not have it be something that, well, if it's got to be 1 point or, you know, 3.2 million or whatever it is, then it can't work. So I guess what I'd like to do is take the two in the appropriations, just make those an open dash. And then as we lay it over, we can talk about what that dollar amount should be, Madam Chair. Would that be acceptable to you?
That sounds good. So Representative Demmer's motion then is, again, on page 2, line 214, strike and leave as a blank the $1,300,000.
Right.
On line 216, strike and leave blank the $1,800,000. And then again on 217 and 218, striking that last sentence that starts any and all grant money and ends in future years.
And that would be my my oral amendment, Madam Chair.
That is Representative Demmer's motion. Any questions? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries and the amendment is adopted. Representative Demmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Spent more time on that than I wanted to, but I think it's important. You know, we've been talking a lot, both in this committee and in our K-12 policy committee, about the need to promote excellence. We've had a lot of things, and I know it's in your bill, about promoting quality in our school district. We've talked about that. And basically what this bill does is it utilizes a framework that's out there, not specific to education, but that's out there that's been used in industry, it's been used in other arenas. The Minnesota Council for Quality, which we'll hear about, as well as the Baldrige criteria. It's a framework around which we try to create a culture of quality within an organization, and it fits well with schools. When I was on the school board in Hayfield back in the 90s, we actually worked on the Baldrige criteria and went down that direction. I was personally very impressed with that, because as they talked about getting all the arrows going one direction, from the superintendent to the school board members, to the teachers, to the custodians, to the cooks, everybody going toward quality made all kinds of sense. It's very systematic and systemic. And that's what this is about. And basically we do two things. We encourage school districts with grants that they can apply for to apply and go through the process. And then if somebody is successful in achieving a high level of award from the Quality Council of the Baldrige, then we look at a grant to allow them to go out and talk about it and expand with other districts about what they've done and why. And so that's from 50,000 feet what we're trying to do here. And from that, I would like to be quiet, which I know that might surprise some people here. But I'm going to be quiet and let our testifiers, we have some very qualified people that can talk about what we're trying to do.
Very good. Thank you, Rep. Demmer. And your first testifier is to your left, I'm assuming.
Yes. This is Merlin Rickless. Merlin.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Rickless. If you could introduce yourself for the tape with your name and title and give us your testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mindy. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Merlin Rickless, Rochester, Minnesota, currently President of Quality Associates International. It's an independent international consulting, and I refer to it as freelance educator, working with clients across the U.S., to some extent in Europe, but primarily in Asia since 1995. Part of the motivation that I have for being a member of the team authoring this particular document is that I had a responsibility in my early years with IBM to be the site quality manager in a leadership role in helping IBM win the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. From there, I became a national examiner and also part of the pilot evaluation team, which adapted that process to education. And in that adaptation process and discussions, we talked about the inability of education to be able to communicate their best practices and winning strategies to other educators, as was the practice and the requirement for industry at that time. So I proposed that there be some provisions made to provide grants to education at that time. But the time was not right. This was in the early 90s. It was a recession, not quite as bad as what we're probably going into today. But Dr. Ryman, whom I was working with at that time, was struggling for his own survival, so this was not accepted. But this has been a long journey for me, and I look forward to this eventually going into legislation. So the concept, as Randy described it, is very simple. The simple part is that we help school districts learn how to improve, even in times as difficult as these, is to help them learn how to increase their achievements with less resource. The next phase, then, is to identify those that are the highest achievers, recognize them as role models, and provide them with the assistance that they need to be able to communicate to others their best practices and their winning strategies. Now, this is based on a fairly very common principle that the best teacher is often a peer that has received discipline training, a rigorous evaluation, recognized for their achievements, and then becomes a leader for what they do. The timing, I think, is exactly right for what we propose, because we now have proven processes and proven criteria which demonstrate that we can in fact increase performance and we can do it with less resource. We can implement by leveraging existing highly respected organizations. We have those in place within Minnesota, the Minnesota Council for Quality, our own Department of Education. We have, in addition to that, enthusiasm among many superintendents and school districts across the state of Minnesota, and you're going to hear from one of those this afternoon. And maybe most importantly, we are in a situation, as you all know as well or better than I, of extreme financial stress. And this last Friday, I listened to our state economist, Tom Stenson, and our state demographer, Tom Gillespie, present their data and conclude, in quote, "Our current situation is not sustainable. Education is key, and we must change and improve, or our way of life as we know it will end." Now, I find that rather profound and something which we all need to take to heart. In the past, well, I might just go back and say the knowledge and experience that I bring to this, in addition to what I mentioned, is 31 years with IBM in areas of research, corporate staff, strategic planning, new product development, and then my last assignment, as I mentioned, as the site quality manager at Rochester, Minnesota. For the past 18 years as an independent international consultant, I've been a 3M McKnight Distinguished Visiting Professor at UMD and have worked across the U.S. and taught as the visiting professor at Chulalongkorn, one of the leading universities in Asia, for 6 years. Also worked with the Thai Productivity Institute in taking the same concepts that we're talking about here today and helping them develop the Thai National Quality Award in 2000. Also worked with UMD, adapting this again to education, in helping UMD receive the Minnesota Council for Quality Gold Level Award in 2001. So we do know that it works. And I also might mention that I work with my partner, Karen, my wife back here, who has experience as a three-term school board member, math teacher, and has helped me do the translation between the business world and the academic world. And that has been invaluable experience. So, in response to anyone who might question that this would be the right time to move ahead on this type of process, make it a part of everything that we do as a way of life, the only answer I can give to you is the one that my dad always gave to me as a kid, and that is that we can't learn any younger and we can't start any sooner. So with that, then I'll turn it over to Brian to give you a little more detail on the process itself.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Lassiter, welcome, and please restate your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you to everybody on the members of the committee. I am Brian Lassiter, President of the Minnesota Council for Quality. For those of you that are not familiar with our organization, we were founded in 1987, actually incubated in the state of Minnesota, spun off into a 501c3 nonprofit 2 years later in 1989. Our mission for those 22 years has really never changed. It's about helping organizations around the state improve their performance and reach higher levels of excellence. We have nearly 300 members, most of them organizations, representing about 150,000 employees in the state. And I was elected president in 2001. Also serving as a volunteer examiner with the Malcolm Aldridge National Quality Year the last 12 years. I want to give you a little overview for those of you that are not deeply familiar with the Aldridge framework about what that program is and what it's intended to do for all types of organizations. It was created by an act of U.S. Congress in 1987, really to help organizations improve their performance and competitiveness. It was adopted by manufacturing first in the late 80s, early 90s, service businesses next in the 1990s, and businesses that are still using the framework, but the faster growing part of our economy are non-businesses. It's schools, both K-12 and higher ed. It's not-for-profits, both pure social nonprofits and governmental agencies. It's healthcare organizations. So now all types of organizations of all sizes and all purposes are using the framework. Aldridge is really about six things.
about helping leaders identify strengths and improvement opportunities within their systems, about facilitating organizational improvement, alignment, and integration within their systems, assisting in the delivery of value to stakeholders by focusing on outcomes, results, and accountability, facilitating organizational and personal learning, and monitoring progress over time. And though important, the recognition component, the award component of our Minnesota Quality Award and the Malcolm Butters National Quality Award, is very secondary to the learning and the improvement that takes place through this process. The Butters framework itself, and I see many of you have the copies of the criteria, is a series of seven interconnected process categories, six process categories and one results category. The process categories are leadership, strategic planning, customer and market focus, measurement, workforce focus, and process management, things that any business, regardless of type and purpose, has to pay attention to. And the seventh category is results. And results really break down in the educational setting to be student achievement, certainly, but also everything that supports student achievement, like workforce focus and stakeholder focus and operations and process and leadership and social outcomes, those types of things. And under those categories sits a set of validated, proven processes that drive excellence within high-performing organizations. So in fact, the set of criteria have become a set of best practices that all organizations can gauge their own performance against. As Randy mentioned, the framework is systemic. It represents a systems view of an organization. It helps leaders identify the connectedness between the different parts of the organization so they can eliminate waste, improve performance, and optimize results. An organization using the framework typically conduct an assessment, either through a third-party organization or an internal self-assessment with their own leaders, to gauge how their performance compares to these set of best practices. Through our Minnesota Quality Award process, we use a volunteer board of about 130 evaluators coming from all over the state and from all different walks of life. We certainly have CEOs and senior executives within business, but we have physicians and surgeons and superintendents and school teachers and nonprofit executives also part of this board. They're all trained by us and give over 100 hours of service a year to helping Minnesota businesses improve. These volunteer board of evaluators follow four general stages of evaluation against these criteria. They do an independent review in which they look at the organization and through their own professional lens identify strengths and improvement opportunities for the organization. They then reach consensus, and our teams are usually 6 to 12 evaluators combined to represent the type of organization that we're evaluating. So after that phase, they have a good, strong, collective view of the strengths and improvement opportunities of the organization that we then test with a site visit. Site visits are somewhat like audits, but they're a little bit deeper. They're 3 or 4 days long, in which we're trying to reach validated conclusions about the true strengths and gaps within the organization. And the process wraps up with a final improvement planning session with senior leaders of the organization, in which the findings are presented and reviewed and priorities for improvement are set. In this way, the evaluation process itself becomes a diagnostic for leaders to understand what's working well and what might be candidates for improvement so that they can quote-unquote focus on those right things. There's a lot of evidence of the power of Baldrige in industry and in schools. In fact, there have been 5 K-12 recipients of the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award from education: Pearl River School District in New York, Chugach Schools in Alaska, Community Consolidated School District 15 in Palatine, Illinois, Jenks Public Schools in Jenksville, Oklahoma, and Iredell Statesville Schools in Statesville, North Carolina. There have also been 3 higher ed institutions received the award. And I'll leave you a transcript of my comments. In there, I've listed some outcomes from these institutions, from K-12 and higher ed, showing that the organizations that have embraced this framework and used it over time really do see improvements in their results, their outcomes, such as student achievement, financial-type results, operating-type results, and so forth. Baldrige has been used heavily in Minnesota. Since our award inception in 1991, there have been 102 Minnesota organizations received the Minnesota Quality Award, and businesses are still using the framework that, as I mentioned, a growing number of non-businesses, including schools, are beginning to use it. There have been 15 Minnesota school districts receive a level of recognition in our Minnesota Quality Award, and we estimate that at least 20 to 25 school districts are currently using the framework either through our formal process or their own continuous improvement initiatives. We believe it's a powerful, proven way to help educational institutions help themselves in improving their outcomes, improving their results, increasing transparency and accountability, engaging its workforce and community stakeholders, learning from each other, and learning from the business community. I believe there's no better time to innovate by using methods of improvement in business to help improve the quality of our schools. Of course, resources are tight. However, many educational leaders, and we'll hear from one here in a moment,
believe it's the absolute best time to invest in their own systems to try to use unique and proven tools to get better. Thank you, and I'll, I suppose, hand it off, and if there are additional questions for me afterwards, I'd be happy to engage in that.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lassiter. No one's on the list yet, so I... and we'll hear from Superintendent Willard, and then if there are questions, we'll take them. And the second bill is a bill from that Representative Winkler has that's also for innovations, and I think both of these bills have potential to tie in with our innovation revenue in-house file, too. So when we've heard both bills on the table, maybe we can have some discussion with both of them and get their ideas about how they could tie in with that. So welcome, Superintendent Willard, and you do know about the innovation revenue because we had a hearing on the new Minnesota Miracle House File 2 in Marshall that was well attended and enthusiastic, I thought. So welcome, and please re-identify yourself for the record.
Certainly. Representative Greiling, other members of the committee, my name is Clint Willard. I'm Superintendent of Marshall Public Schools. Absolutely delighted to be here today. I know in recent history, several of you have actually come to Marshall to visit us. So I'm delighted to be here to visit with you today and talk about an issue that's very near and dear to the Marshall Public Schools, very near and dear to me for a couple of reasons, and obviously something that I believe is very important for the state of Minnesota as we look to our future. We've referenced House File 2, and this is obviously a very nice fit with House File 2 as we consider the overall premise of education in the state of Minnesota as we're going forward. I know that we all share a passion today for our public school systems, and we know that through that passion, we've heard time and time again that Minnesota is not in a position where we're going to necessarily be cheaper than anyone else and be cheaper than our national competitors and our international competitors, namely China and India, but we do have an opportunity to be competitive in the area of quality, and that's where this fits very nicely. When you look at what schools are given in terms of opportunities to share best practices and how they can grow and improve and really do the things that are expected for our communities and for our state into the future as we look at developing future leaders, developing future workforce, the legislators, and those things that are going to take shape into the future, those opportunities aren't presented very often where we're having those discussions in a systemic way. Oftentimes we hear and have opportunities where we might visit about a certain concept, but not about improving our system. And when you look at what Edward Deming did with Japan years ago, he did what he did because he knew that they needed a systems change and they were willing to embrace a systems change. He's argued that up to 94% of the issues that occur within a structure are systemic needs that have to be identified and fixed. So when you look at what House File 1001 does, and I agree, it's a great number, easy to remember, it does open the door to pave the way for schools to share, as was articulated earlier, from peers that have gone the way. As was articulated by Brian Laster earlier through the process, I have had an opportunity to visit four of those five National Builders Awards recipient school districts. I wouldn't have done that if we wouldn't have been so focused on trying to improve the quality of our schools in Marshall as a result of that. And a key driver for that is the fact that we have business partners in our community that are embracing this journey with us as we go forward. U.S. Bank Corps has a very significant presence in Marshall, and through our partnership and focus on quality outcomes and outputs, we received a $10,000 grant from them. Why? The president of that operation said because it is so important, not only for his children, but the children of every employee that they're working on attracting and retaining in the state of Minnesota at that profit center. So when you consider the broader scheme, you can see that it is a critical piece systemically for the state of Minnesota when we look at paving the way and focused on quality outputs, not just on the inputs. An important piece that I believe needs to be heard. Again, focusing on the outputs, not just the inputs. Let's talk about those outputs for a second. I can give you real-life examples of what that's meant for Marshall. We recently went through a quality evaluation process with the Minnesota Council of Quality. It was brutal. We came back with some very noted opportunities for improvement. It made a superintendent cringe, but it was a very reflective practice that helps us get better. and it engages every single facet of our workforce on getting better. We have a comprehensive committee in our school system. We have about 2,200 students, but I have representatives from my custodial bargaining unit, my support staff, paraprofessional bargaining unit, our teachers bargaining unit, our principals, superintendents at the table, as well as the directors that represent other organizational components of our district, all focused on the same conversation: how do we make Marshall Public Schools better? I would challenge you to find another school district other than those that have gone through the process that are having that focused and that comprehensive of a dialogue right now with all of those different stakeholder groups. So when we look at what those outcomes measure, we look at things such as our student performance. That's number one. We're in the business of student achievement. Beyond that, however, we also look at satisfaction and engagement of our teaching staff and our support staff, of our community that we have to rely upon through operating referendum and through other mechanisms to support our schools. We also look at those performance outcomes in regards to our financial obligations that we have to retain quality teachers and to measure the quality of our staff and our ongoing professional development efforts to improve the quality of our staff. All of those outputs are measured annually through an ongoing process that really focuses our organization on best allocation of resources on outcomes that we need to arrive at. I'll conclude my comments by saying this. When you're talking about quality, it is not a political issue. It's not a partisan issue. It's a Minnesota issue. And it's something that Minnesota has a proud tradition of in so many ways. Arguably, we have one of the finest public school systems, not only in the country, but in the world. However, we can get better. And through this process, schools can learn how to improve and how to get better through critical evaluation and then sharing through that process those best practices that help others get better. And I'm sharing this passion with you not only today as a school superintendent, but as a father. I have a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old. I look at their future and say that nothing is more important than high-quality schools and sharing that quality so that everybody can get better. So I do stand ready for questions that others from the committee might have. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to visit with you about something that I share a great deal of passion about, and I certainly hope that through this call to action, all of you will certainly endorse this opportunity as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Superintendent Willard. We do have a couple questions, and we'll take questions and any testimony there might be from the audience. Then we'll have the second bill, and then we can have some discussion between the two, I think. Representative Dietrich and then Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for the superintendent. And, sir, you're the superintendent from Marshall?
That is correct.
Nice to see you again.
Yes.
I was.
Yes, it is a pleasure, yes.
You were passionate and very eloquent there when we were there, and you are again today. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. So, is Marshall a QComp school district?
That is correct.
Willard.
Yes, that is correct. Marshall is a QComp school district.
Okay.
Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, ma'am. And so how does this Baldrige model mesh with QComp?
Superintendent Dietrich. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to call her Dr. Dietrich a minute ago.
That would be okay, too.
I don't know if that was a promotion or not. But
I am what I am, no matter what you call me.
That's a wonderful question and one that I'd be delighted to share about, because QComp obviously is a very important discussion that this legislative body has considered as well. Marshall was one of the first implementers of QComp, I believe number 3 on the list in the state of Minnesota. So certainly something that we're very proud of. We would not have done QComp if it did not have a systemic improvement effort as part of it. And the systemic improvement is focused through this continuous improvement model. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, they fit hand and glove. Our QComp system is so focused on outputs. Not inputs, outputs. We have payments for teachers and principals based on performance goals that tie into school improvement plans, district-wide student achievement gains, personal goals and personal improvement gains within the classroom practices that are taking place on a daily basis, an annual basis. So all of those things are very integral to our continuous improvement efforts utilizing this framework.
Thank you. So I have to just ask some, I'm not intimately familiar with QComp, and QComp is different in every district, so you hate to ask too many questions because you don't totally understand it. But can you give me some of the data from your teachers then? And I'm interested on the QComp side of it. Are you one of the schools, did every teacher benefit in your district from QComp?
Superintendent Willard.
Financially,
okay. I was gonna ask for a little bit of clarification. Financially, yes, every teacher has the opportunity to benefit, but not at the same level. And the reason that occurs is certain portions of salaries are augmented based upon the attainment of those goals. So each teacher in our district, regardless of similar years of experience and degree attainment, they are not paid the same. They are not compensated the same simply because of the variables that exist within our structure. Building it through a framework like this, where it's focused on those outputs, looking at things such as district-wide student achievement, like I said, student achievement gains, student gains in the classroom if around a certain cohort group of students. A key component of this, and this goes to the other side of the question, did all teachers benefit? Part of the framework that you see before you deals a great deal with the ongoing professional development and quality of the staff that you have as well. The QComp structures have afforded us the opportunity to embrace those best practices with professional development, through job-embedded professional development, and we measure the effects of that utilizing the process in front of you. So we are doing in-process measures. We ask our staff members, and if you walked into my principal's offices right now, you would see posted on their walls how our staff have responded in levels of satisfaction and engagement around those measures of performance in those professional development opportunities. We take those in-process measures very seriously. We're a data-driven district because of the meshing of the QComp process along with the continuous improvement process. So I hope I answered your question.
Yes, thank you for the follow-up, Madam Chair. Yes, you did, the first part of it. Second part, then, would be, is can you tell me what the range of teacher QComp reward was?
Superintendent Willard.
Anywhere from zero to, and this is a bit off the top of my head, so you'll have to bear with me, anywhere from zero to as high as approximately $2,000, and that's how we have it structured. Again, you can receive no gain if you're not showing improvements. If you're showing improvements to a level that's commensurate, you're going to see certain levels of gains. So there's so many different factors that are part of that, but not everybody benefits the same. Not everybody is given X number of dollars for going through the process. And we haven't used it to buy staff development days. We've used it to focus on job-embedded professional development and attainments in those areas that we've talked about. And we do have teachers that have written personal improvement plans, personal goal plans on parent engagement. I want more parents to attend my classroom's parent-teacher conferences, for example. And they involve themselves in engagement strategies with parents to ensure that if we have an at-risk population, for example, where we've had typically low attendance because we know what research tells us about parent engagement and student achievement, if they're showing gains in that area, they have opportunities. We also, like I said, utilize student achievement data to measure improvement gains in the areas particularly focused on mathematics and reading, simply because that's measured through the MCA 2 assessments, but the NWEAs are the assessments that we utilize from the beginning of the year to the end of the school year to measure those improvements
and how we're doing so that we can close out a contract in a timely basis.
Representative Marquardt and then Representative Newton.
Thank you very much, and I really enjoy this conversation here. And Representative Demmer, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I just focus on results. I mean, that's what it should all be about. And Madam Chair, one of the things I really like about your new Minnesota Miracle is it's got innovation and results components to it. And I think that's so important. And Representative Dietrich is part of a working group out of the Property Tax Division that's working with accountability on the property tax system, not only statewide, but also with performance measurement and improvement systems in cities and counties. And the Baldrige program came up several times in our working group with these folks who are working with all this, and it's the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It just really is the way to go. And I guess my question is, for superintendent, is a couple things. Is, first of all, since you've really gone into this performance type stuff and focusing on results, how has the conversation changed, even within school board members, versus before that? And then the second thing is, do you use the data you get and so forth into your budgeting process and looking at how you can provide more value for taxpayers and so forth?
Superintendent Willard.
I'll speak to that on a couple of fronts. It certainly has changed the conversation from where we were to where we are. When you look at what schools have the opportunities to do, there are a tremendous number of opportunities because we service so many different constituents out there. And some people have argued that the school superintendency is probably the highest pressure position in the world because of all the different constituents, from retirees to that five-year-old that's entering kindergarten, and representing and listening to all those needs that need to be covered. Our conversations have changed on how we go about doing that, though. We don't simply do something because we can. We do something because it's aligned to our outcomes that we've identified through a strategic planning process that engaged every single one of those stakeholders in our community. As we built our strategic plan, it took a tremendous amount of time, but I sat down with every single graduating senior from Marshall High School for 2 years in a row, and I asked them in about a 10 or 15 minute conversation, what is it that we need to do to make our school better? They have nothing to lose, and they're coming straight to me to tell me that opportunity. We took all of that input. We also worked in partnership with the with a certain agency, the Neighborhood House here in Minneapolis, to do a community-wide needs assessment survey on what is it that we need to do as a community to prepare for our community's needs in the future. Every single household in Marshall Public Schools was surveyed. Through that survey, we utilized a Pareto charting process, it's a data charting process, to take that feedback and identify those areas that are most significant and most important for our community going forward. That has focused on what we do. Instead of doing everything because we can or because somebody wants us to, it's focused the conversation on what we should do. And then that speaks to the second half of your conversation as well, which is, in our budgeting processes, we've been transitioning to more of a performance-based budget process where we're looking at how resources align to a programmatic approach to what it is that we need to do in our district to embrace what it is that we have going forward. And it's a very dynamic, very rich process, a very robust process that engages our community in a dialogue. And that is a key component of the Baldrige criteria, is that community engagement. Some districts do that well. Other districts do it better. I believe we're in the category that does it better because of this criteria and this focus that we have.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is actually for Representative Demmer. You know, this morning we learned a new word with Wiki, and the shared services that were presented so nicely by Representatives McFarland and Swale. And I'm just wondering if we can't do something like this with shared knowledge and shared information and take some of the concepts and the Baldrige idea and have that on a statewide basis so that we're not having to pay money for it, but school districts are exchanging information and we have a repository that we can rely on.
Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Newton, for the question. Actually, I think one of the beauties of this, and actually this does have a component, and I was going to address this in my closing remarks, but this is really a localized process. You know, we all come from different parts of the state. There's the range, there's southwest, there's southeast, there's the Twin City metro area, there's the urban areas, and all have different cultures, all have different views and ideas about what excellence might be in their particular arena. And I think those particulars may be different in the different school districts, but the framework itself and the process you go through to get to what those are is common. And I think in the bill, we have some incentive for school districts to get some money so they can pay for their staff to put the framework together to do the application. It's a lot of work. But then what we do is for those school districts that do capture it, that do get the essence of what they're trying to accomplish with this framework and able to come up with the levels of achievement based on criteria that the Council for Quality establishes as well as Baldrige, then we have dollars that school districts can get to use because it does cost money if they go around and talk about this framework and what they accomplish. Not necessarily to share what their vision of excellence was, but to share with them how they arrived at it, so that others can do the same thing. Listening to Superintendent we are all here because we care about education. That's why we're in this committee. And we're fortunate because a lot of other people would like to be here. And yes, we discuss, we debate, we argue, we disagree on some specifics, but we all want excellence in education. I think we even can be inspired by somebody like Superintendent Willard, who talks about what they've done, the time and effort they put in, and what they've accomplished. And I think that's what we're trying to replicate by these achievement grants, to go out with somebody who's achieved a high level so they can go out and be mentors and share that in that spirit, if you will, of shared services, to go out and say, this is what we thought was excellent. Here's the way we set up our program. It might include Q Comp, it might not, whatever. But here is the way we got to where we got. And I think that's what we're talking about when we're talking about sharing. So that component of what you're talking about, shared services, I think is kind of built in with these, what we call diligence grants, to go out and continue to share that methodology.
Okay, we'll take one more question that we have on the list, and then we'll get the other bill before us, and then we can have the dialogue. And I'm going to be asking both of the groups how they would see themselves working complementary with the other one. But even though Rep. Dan Winkler isn't here, his testifier is, and she will have to proceed without him if he's not here when Representative Ward's question is over. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to Superintendent Ward, and it's in reference to Representative Dietrich's question earlier about the Q-Comp differentiating levels. In the district that I, one district that I represent that has Q-Comp, as I recall, the staff has an opportunity to say, I want to participate, and we'll get an equal amount of revenue or rewards, or I don't want to participate and I will get nothing. I don't ever remember a district saying, okay, we have different levels of rewards. So, maybe I've been sitting in the corner too long and not listening to that. But can you tell me, with those different levels, have you had contractual problems? Have you had morale problems? Or, I mean, has that led to personnel problems at all? It's intriguing to me because, that's my question.
Superintendent Willard.
So, good question. In order to address that, what we have is, again, as a staff-driven Q-Comp oversight committee that's part of our district. So if we end up with a discrepancy that somebody feels is an injustice, for whatever reason, they can appeal the process to that committee, and it is agreed through our contract and through our Q-Comp dealings that the consensus arrived at through that committee, which does include myself, school principals, are what we call peer coaches, coordinating teachers. There are professional development leaders that are staff members. They are the ones that ultimately then decide whether or not somebody has met the attainment of the goals and the outcomes. We've had a couple of appeals that have gone through that process. We've had some people that have been denied. And because the process is very collaborative and very collegial, it's worked. And we have not had any contractual disputes over that, which I believe puts, maybe I'm a little biased, but I believe that Marshall's the model for the entire state of Minnesota as we go forward with that process, because we have been effective in how we've done that. And there are always challenges when you're talking compensation and organizational structures, but back to the heart of what we're talking about here, we are continually evaluating those things. We do what we call in-process measures as part of that, language that we've arrived at through the continuous improvement process. And our contract is aligned very directly to the entire premise of the continuous improvement model. You can't separate the two in Marshall Public Schools.
Okay, thank you. Representative Demmer, any closing comments? But again, and thank you to all the testifiers and Superintendent Willard from coming all the way from Marshall. We may want to, as I said, bring you back into the conversation. But Representative Demmer, any closing comment before we lay your bill over for possible inclusion?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Newton kind of led me into that, so I made a lot of the comments I was going to make. You know, it's about establishing a culture, and it's locally driven, and I think it's an excellent framework to work with, and it's something we didn't have to come up with. It's been come up with, and it's been used and tried and true in other places. And actually, Madam Chair, I've got to say this, too. It did occur to me that maybe the legislature could benefit from this process, too.
Representative Demmer, I think all of us would agree with that. And go ahead.
Well, with that, Madam Chair, I would just renew my motion that House File 1001 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 education bill.
Representative Demmer renews his motion that House File 1001 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Eilert, this is Representative Winkler's bill, House File 1188. That's a little bit harder, but still a memorable number. And Representative Winkler is, I think, presenting a bill in another committee as well. Ms. Eilers?
He presented yesterday before the E-12 committee.
But, I mean, where is he right now?
Oh, at the moment, Madam Chair, I believe he's on a conference call with his employer.
That's what it was. Okay, never mind about that. I think he's presenting two bills at once. Okay, well, since this bill is not technically before us, eight people on this committee, Ms. Eilers, serve on K-12 policy as well. But the rest have not heard this bill at all. So we're going to have a full presentation, and then we will go for questions. And it's still in policy, and they haven't passed. It probably will come to us in some form in the policy omnibus bill that will be heard in this committee and part of our omnibus bill eventually. So we don't have to move it, and we can't amend it, but we do have it here. So when it does come, we'll have spent some time with it and understand it, and we wanted to see the interplay between this one and Representative Demmer's bill. So welcome to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself more formally and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Angie Eilers. I'm the Research and Policy Director at Growth and Justice. Thanks for the opportunity to speak before you once again, and I apologize to those of you who've heard this a few times. It's always a pleasure to be able to talk about what we're calling Smart Investments in Minnesota Students. This is a research-based investment proposal that also has a cost-benefit analysis associated with it. Making a good strategic plan, we began with a long-term view of aiming out to the year 2020, by which we're calling for an increase by 50% of the number of students who finish a post-secondary degree of some kind, a one or a two or a four-year degree. Primarily for the reason being that a student will have a hard time making a living wage in Minnesota any longer with just a high school diploma. We'd like to see that more students get something beyond high school, and particularly our students of color and Native American population who have not necessarily benefited from the post-secondary institutions to the extent our white population has. And the reason why we're aiming ambitiously toward a 50% increase is that at our current rate in 2006, when last measured by the Office of Higher Ed Minnesota Measures Report, there's a combined rate of students who hold a BA or an A or a two-year or four-year degree, a total of 52%, and that is an age cohort between the ages of 25 and 35, the cohort that is best positioned to enter the workforce. And the state demographer projects that if we do nothing between now and the year 2020, that combined rate will shrink back to 38%. whereby one in four students would hold a bachelor's degree and only 13% an associate's degree. And that's unfortunately moving in the wrong direction, just as our economy requires more of a student and is more globally competitive. So we began with the question of how and where to invest in our students, knowing that we'd like to move from 52% to something more like 75% of our students who hold an advanced degree by the year 2020. And we argue that we don't choose among our children. We'd like to invest in all of our children from birth to college, but that we'd like to invest very strategically in our students where the needs are the greatest. And I'm sorry if the, is that aligned on, I don't know, it doesn't look right on here, but we began with a strategic mapping, and I think in some ways this map reflects similar language used in the Baldrige process. The strategic plan begins with a long-term goal, setting out by the year 2020 with a finishing rate, a numeric number of 50% increase. But we look back into the pathway of where our students are along the in their readiness for post-secondary achievement. And we reflected in this, the blue shaded benchmarks reflect statutory requirements that by the year 2013-2014, all of our students will need to read at the third grade level or above by the end of third grade. They will be taking and passing Algebra 1 in the 8th grade, and in the high school years, taking and passing Algebra 2 and other rigorous coursework, chemistry, physics, and other advanced sciences. And while it's not statutorily required that all children begin kindergarten ready to learn, I think we know cognitively and otherwise that when children are ready for kindergarten, they're more likely to be reading at the third grade level. So in order to break down this analysis, we had to ask the question, so where are our students in each of these important benchmarks? I won't drag you through all of the bar graphs and spreadsheets on that. I think many of you are very well acquainted with some of our student numbers. Half of our children are ready for kindergarten. There are tens of thousands of third graders who are not reading. We don't currently have algebra offered in the 8th grade, but even those who are taking algebra in the 9th grade are not at a proficiency level where they need to be, etc. There are some figures that are a snapshot of 4th and 8th grade reading proficiency. Sadly, these are the number of students who are off track or the students who are not at a proficiency level that correlates with their likely likeliness of taking and passing more rigorous high school coursework. I chose to use the National Assessment of Education Progress figures because the literature suggests that this assessment is more tightly linked with rigorous coursework in high school. You can also see that our math figures are not that much different, unfortunately. And you can also see that our graduation rates do look differently. While we do have a high number of students who are not proficient in math and reading, we're graduating them at any rate. And where that shows up is in post-secondary remediation. 34% of Minnesota students are being remediated in their first year of either their two-year or their four-year program. That's an expense, a very large expense to the state for remediation. It's also an expense to the student who's spending an additional year of tuition money at a relatively high rate. At any rate, there are a number of measures in which we can see warning signs about the lack of readiness and lack of proficiency for our students to stay on track to finish at a level that's going to ready them to enroll in and succeed in a post-secondary degree. But then the next question is, knowing the number of students who are not on track, what can we do to interrupt that? This slide didn't show up, unfortunately. That's all right. I don't know what.
We have it in our handouts, at least
okay.
For most of us who have the handouts.
All right. Oh, actually, it's a built-in sort of thing. So the question was, what are the most effective interventions known in the extant body of literature that show decent effect moving students from less than proficient to proficient? And then we asked ourselves an even more strict, put ourselves through another strict filter, which are what are the most cost-effective interventions? And again, this is a comprehensive investment proposal from birth to college. Many of these interventions, I know many of you are familiar with it, they show up in the literature and in our state over and over again, and in some cases, these interventions do exist in our state, but are only available to a small percentage of students. We'd like to think that all of our students in Minnesota should be able to benefit from what we can afford them. I'm not sure if you want to go to the great lengths of walking through the interventions. You do have them in your handouts, and I think the interest today is in the bill language, which calls for a overarching oversight advisory council that would represent a variety of experts and specialists who can focus on these particular segments of the population, as well as building in some legislative and commissioner oversight and process. But in summary, I'd also like to point out we offer promising interventions. While they may not either we separate effective interventions from promising interventions, in that effective interventions have shown decent effect size over a long period of time, replicated in many settings, and a cost analysis that is beneficial. The promising practices either are underway and are showing early indicators of being effective, or they do not have a current cost-benefit analysis associated with them, but they certainly bear mentioning. And the final few slides I'd like to share with you is really the amount of money that we're calling for the number of students. And how I arrived at these figures is to multiply the number of students who are not at a benchmark or the proficiency level where they need to be, multiplied by the cost of the intervention, and these figures show the considerable dollars that need to be dedicated and invested in students to get them on their pathway. Again, you have these figures in front of you. I think what I'd like to say in closing before segueing over to the actual language of the bill is that ultimately what we hope this proposal represents, whether it's adopted and fully and completely in the way that it's articulated, it's really about the framing principles, and that is that we hope that our system calls for investing in the whole child, both their social, academic, and financial needs, their health, human, and academic needs, as well as very comprehensively from early childhood years, K-12 years, and into higher education, again, not making choices among our children. And finally, to address and invest in our children where their needs are at in a more targeted and effective method. I don't feel entirely prepared to speak on behalf of Representative Winkler, but I'll give it a shot. What Representative Winkler's interest, I believe, is in carrying this bill is to forward a recommendation that develops an oversight body that brings to bear more interest and accountability at each level of a child's educational pathway, an early childhood, K-12, and a post-secondary transition oversight committee, and that this body would encompass state involvement, both the legislative and the executive branch, and with a set of experts to bring analysis to the issues at hand. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Eilers. I don't see anyone on the list at the moment. Is there anyone with a question? Okay, well, those of us who do serve on policy committee know that the policy committee, in fact, the very same, was that just yesterday or the day before yesterday, that we heard this bill and some other bills. There are a variety of bills with a variety of, this one has the Oversight Advisory Committee, and there's we will be hearing to reinstate the State Board of Education. There's other several other proposals for groups that would help us with knowing what would qualify for innovation revenue. As you know, in House File 2, school districts that are doing well on the test become the best practices districts. It could be on the common, what did you call that, Representative Newton? Did you say wiki?
The wiki.
Okay. They could be on that, and others could check with Marshall and other places to find out what could they do to get their students to be doing better with the best practices through through Growth and Justice and Baldrige or whatever. And then others would have to come up with a plan that would be approved. So we need some sort of a group to do that approving. I think the policy committee is actually looking right now at having all districts do that, not just those whose test scores and other measures need to improve, thinking that every district could improve. So we'll see what they send us. But in the meanwhile, we have two of the proposals in front of us, and I would like to hear from Ms. Eilers first, and then I see we've lost Representative Demmer as well, but anybody who's here who testified for his bill, to comment, if you can, on, I know Ms. Eilers was there, to comment on how this how this might tie in with the innovation revenue from House File 2.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. As I understand it, there would be available funds up to as much as 5% by which districts could perhaps apply, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Apply for innovation funds, and we would argue that if there are going to be additional dollars used by the district, that they request funds that are known to show an effect for their students. Ultimately, we'd like to see the needle move for students from below proficiency to proficiency to as high a quality of educational achievement as they can attain. And rather than be subject to vendor programs that come by the way of a school district or, dare I say, a FAD, we'd like to think that districts should have access to a clearinghouse or a menu of options that are known to have shown decent effect and have been replicated in other settings and is something within their budget that they could afford. So ideally, a cost analysis would be associated with any of these reform initiatives so that districts know what they are getting into and can hope with some confidence to have an effect in the long run.
Very good. And Superintendent Willis, the same question, and then we'll take dialogue from members. And we have one representative on the list already. Superintendent Willard, if you could restate your name for the record.
Yes, I certainly can. Superintendent Clint Willard from Marshall Public Schools. There is a very nice alignment between what is being suggested by Growth and Justice and House File 1001 as well. It is the concept of sharing of best practices and moving the needle, as was shared before. When you look at what's gone on a national level with the continuous improvement movement and particularly the five districts across the country that have received the National Malcolm Baldrige Quality Award, which was put into law quite a few years ago, actually, by the federal government, it is about embracing and sharing those best practices. What you see in House File 1001 ties and models what's going on at the national level with sharing of those best practices. Those national recipients are awarded a small grant to share what they do with their quality improvements that are research-driven. They are best practices that are identified as such. They're not the latest fad or the latest trend, going back to what I testified to earlier, doing what you should do versus doing what you could do, given the plethora of opportunities that exist out there, from those that are very well researched and very proven to this is the latest and greatest fad that we're going to try to dip into your pocket for. So there is a very tight alignment, and obviously I believe both parameters fit nicely under the innovation component of House File 2.
Very good. I'm going to ask the first question. Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, what exactly was the amount of money? Was it about $5 million for the innovation revenue for the average district if House File 2 were fully implemented?
Madam Chair, the number was 5% of the total formula revenue, which would be about 5% of $7.5 billion. And we were just stumbling about what to think of an average district, I suppose.
I'm thinking like Marshall. I should tell you where I'm going with this, so you could answer it better. I'm wanting to know if Marshall had the innovation revenue that they would qualify for with House File 2, if it were fully implemented, how much would that be? And then I want to compare it with how much they actually spent. So do you need a little time to...
No.
Okay. All right. These guys are so smart. All right. Mr. Crow.
Well, Madam Chair, 5% of 7,500 is $375. So roughly $375 a kid. So if it's a 1,000 kid district, it's $375,000 that'd be available to them.
And Superintendent Willard, is that about how many students you have?
We have about 2,200 students. I can believe 2,174. Not adjusted. That's a one student, one count versus the weighted enrollment.
All right, Mr. Crow.
So, Madam Chair, since House File 2 uses an unweighted pupil count, that would be about $825,000.
About $825,000. So, Ms. Superintendent Willard, how much did you spend for this, and what would you do beyond that if you'd had the $800,000? Would that be way more than you needed? We're trying to get a handle on amounts and so forth. So how much did you spend, and then what would you see yourself doing beyond that with $800,000?
Well, what we spend, we allocate on an annualized basis about $20,000 that supports our continuous improvement efforts as we're doing what we do internally. What you see articulated in House File 1001 is the opportunity then to take that to the next level, which is the sharing of that through the best practice research and what has been learned through the journey with others. And that's why you saw those dollar figures opened up and adjusted accordingly per the oral amendment from Representative Demmer, because we know that there is an opportunity to share. Again, going back to what's happened on the national level, the Jenks Public School System, which has stolen one of Minnesota's finest, he's actually a former superintendent of Minnesota. He's the superintendent of Jenks Public Schools. He's had been superintendent, I believe, at Invergrove Heights. They were a national recipient a few years ago. Every February, they hold a conference at their school site where they invite districts from across the country to come in and learn from their best practices. I also know from speaking with the superintendent, former superintendent of the Chugach School District up in Chugach, Alaska, they created a manual about this thick on reinventing schools. And at the time that they created that manual, it was a huge undertaking. They hired additional staff to create that manual, but it was to share out that best practice with others. And I actually have a copy of that manual, and in the process of obtaining a copy of that, what was interesting in the conversation was the highest consumer of that manual was actually a philanthropic effort taking shape over in India, the equivalent of Bill Gates here in the United States. So it tells us something about seeking the opportunity to find those best practices and then sharing them at a greater level. And again, that's where the alignment fits. So to speak to what we spent specifically, a different conversation than what's on the table, obviously.
So, yep, and yours was more of the process and then
right.
Some of the things you could do.
This will take it to the next level of sharing that. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. That's some Dietrich.
All right, I'll pass, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions from any members or any testimony from the audience? Please come forward. Welcome to the committee, and if you could tell us your name for the record.
My name is Judith Geldinger, and I'm a constituent in Carol McFarland's district. And this is totally impromptu. I can't believe I'm doing this, but
you can see we're welcoming it today.
Well, okay. Thank you. I'm a speech language pathologist, and I have been working in Minnesota Public Schools since 1981, give or take a couple of years when I went and got my master's degree in Madison. And as of June, I will be leaving the public schools because I'm totally burned out from everything, and that's a real tragedy, but I'm still going to try to be involved to these things. But I just want to comment. I come from a totally different background as a speech language pathologist. I work in an educational setting, but we are a clinical degree, and we can work in other settings too, and we have kind of a disconnect because of that. And as I started to work in the schools, I've been always amazed and disappointed how the teachers don't seem to have the basic knowledge of development or a lot of things, and it's all stems back to what they get trained at the university. And that's 25 years ago that came to me, and I don't know that that has changed. So when I see this money you're talking about, and it sounds well and good, it's kind of a lot of patting on the back of the same things over and over again. We're not changing anything. And if you're going to talk about, you know, the appropriations and talking about different overseers of different births or whatever, you need to have the whole educational piece put into that includes higher education, because the teacher colleges, who's ever teaching or training teachers, need to be part of this, because they need to be making the changes, and they aren't. Some maybe are, but most of them aren't yet. And it's interesting. I was in the policy committee this morning, and the last person that spoke was a member of Senate who brought in by the, I think it's the chairperson, I don't know who brought in, and it was a, happened to be a woman of color, an older woman that had taught in years past. And she used a term that I love, because it's just my frustration for years, recipe teacher. And that's all we teach. And I remember having this conversation in the fall of 2003, or maybe it was the spring of 2003, I guess it doesn't matter, with the Dean of Education from St. Thomas, University of St. Thomas. And I said, you know, I asked her, I said, my understanding, to think of a line with, you know, 0 to 10, and you think of 10 students or 100 students in the classroom. And we're talking about the special ed kids that are at the bottom, and we've got the gifted kids at the top, and let's say it's the top 10 and the bottom 10, okay? So we've got that 80% in the middle that the regular ed teachers are supposed to be accommodating, correct? That if, you know, if we look at it that way, well, we're supposed to be accommodating everybody. In reality, we train teachers to deal with those 70, 90 kids that are going to get it by and large anyway. So they need teachers that can do and deal with all those other kids that we're all talking about, that are taking it. And, you know, I am not a brilliant person. You know, I did very well in school, and I was given a good brain, and I'm passionate about learning, and I'm passionate, I keep at this, and I keep coming back to try to do this, and it's not, we have two comps in my district, too, and I'm not going to say which district to work for.
Excuse me just a minute, so I can kind of gear your time. Representative Winkler has arrived, and he's
okay.
The bill author we did not hear from, so we want to get to him fairly soon, so if you could conclude.
Well, I'll just wind up, but I just think that, to me, a lot of these things are a repetition of things over and over again, and it's like patting ourselves on the back, you know, the Q comp, until I can see it just where we're really seeing changes in student performance. A lot of Q comp, the teachers, yeah, they get, if they show that they've kind of learned something new, that's one thing, but if there's not that additional piece who's going to oversee that, and again with excellence, you're missing, again, it's that student achievement. We're still not getting it, dealing with the teacher and all this time. It's just, they're not getting it. I mean, we're just spending the same money on the same things, and we've got to relook at it totally different. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but I worked in Minneapolis for 20 years, and I worked in another inner city, Brooklyn Center, and it's just, you know, high poverty and all the kids we're talking about. So,
thank you very much, and if you have more, you
thank
can
you.
Let Representative McFarland know, and she's sitting right here at the table, and she does, when she has something to say, she certainly lets us know, so thank you. Representative Winkler, we did have a very nice presentation from Ms. Zeiler. She said she hated to speak for you, but then she went ahead and did and described your bill, and but we do have some time left, and I'll just to put it in context, the first bill we heard was Representative Demers' bill. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that or not, but the two bills, the testifiers decided went very well together, and as you know, we're trying to get, working with the policy committee, the language right to tie in with the innovation revenue for House File 2, and we, you know, these two bills we thought were pretty strikingly made for that little spot, and so we wanted to hear them. And they are complementary, and obviously don't know what we've already done with discussion and everything, but we would like to hear from you and anything you might want to say about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my apologies for being late. I hope you'll understand that this is sort of the time of the year, for things to spin out a little bit. I'd like to address, I think, what this bill and what the report from Growth and Justice can actually really add to the innovation revenue piece of House File 2. I think it is alignment and direction towards a goal that is a crucial public policy goal for the state and a goal that I think most Minnesotans can get behind. As you know, Angie's presented on the ultimate policy outcome of increasing the number of post-high school degrees by 50% in the state of Minnesota. that ties, I think, directly into a lot of the difficult economic and demographic information we've been getting from the state economists and from a lot of other people about the needs for the workforce in the future in this state. Tom Stinson has been very clear that the best correlation in economic success in the world is the percentage of your population with a high school degree. And in Minnesota, historically, we have not only the United States has led the world, Minnesota has led the nation. And that the rate that we are seeing in recent years is pushing us away from that. And the achievement gap is part of that. So when you look at an economic imperative, I think that trying to align towards a goal of achieving a certain level of post-secondary attainment is very sensible from an economic and from a broader public policy perspective. And so that is the goal of House File 1188, to try to look not only at where we could spend new money, but look at existing systems from birth through 16 to try to align, according to research, programs and funds that we already use. And so there's no committee at the legislature, and there is no State Department or organized group whose purpose is to look at how we can use existing and additional funds for three-year-olds to third grade in literacy. That's, of course, an important policy goal. The question is, how can we review and realign towards the goal of getting kids able to read by third grade? Angie has gone over all this. The bill is recognizing, I think much like the House File 2 recognizing, that we have to get through a period of very difficult times. But when we come out of that, and as we pull out of that, we have to be pulling towards something. We have to be, I think, clear that there needs to be a strong economic, a strong education vision for the state of Minnesota after we pull through. And so I think that's what the promise of this bill really is that it's aligning it with broad goals that the public can support and that are very crucial for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Rep. Winkler. And we think that before we get done this year, despite the financial difficulties, we have a way to keep this, a method to get this into our future, even in legislation this year. So we are very glad that you brought the bill forward and that Representative Demmer did. And does anyone else have any questions or comments? Sir, please come forward, Mr. Rickliff. If you could restate your name for the tape.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity to come back and make a few more comments. Merlin Rickliff, to give an overall perspective of how the comments that have been made, I think, tie together, and tie together very well. The Baldrige is focused on process, and I believe what I've heard, the other bill is focused on methods and techniques, research methods and techniques, which have been demonstrated to work. By proceeding with the implementation of the Baldrige, there's a structure and a discipline that's put in place within every organization that chooses to implement it. That structure and organization includes the leadership defining their goals of what they want to achieve. It identifies and makes them think and implement how they communicate those goals to everyone within the organization in a manner that those individuals understand, which means you might transmit and communicate to the janitor in a way completely different than you would to the teacher in the classroom. But the bottom line is it requires the leadership to communicate those goals, again, in a manner that everyone understands. It requires also that there be measurements and that there be defined processes. So that the measurements can track how the institution is progressing towards the goals that were established and then communicated to everyone within the organization. In the end, it comes down to then what are the results? And once one has received the results, it's an analysis of what did we do well, what could we have done better, and then identify what can then be changed to go back and improve and then do the process all over again. The merit of marrying these two together is, as I understand it from this brief discussion, many new educational approaches at all levels within the institution are proposed here. Each of those can be measured by an organization that's actively implementing the Baldrige process to determine which ones are most effective, if they're effective at all, and if they're not, or if they're not as effective as they could be. The process is a way of life, it's a way of thinking that everyone within the organization eventually learns how to live with, to again define what's working well, what could be improved, what do we change, let's make the change, and then go back and do it again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And unfortunately, our policy committee chair, Rep. Mariani, has what so many people have this week and last week, that very bad cough and so forth, and so he had to go home ill. So we'll trust that members of the policy committee who are on this committee, and Rep. Winkler and Rep. Demmer particularly, will help us keep track of the language, because we're asking the policy committee to send us language that we can put together with the funding in the ultimate bill this year that will keep all these things intertwined. And so hopefully all of you will check over the language, advise us as we go forward, so we're sure to have something that has as much potential as possible for our students. So thank you. It's an excellent hearing, and the meeting is adjourned.